That being the case, thank you for attending. I'd like to have the opportunity to navigate through the agenda to try to get to the items that would require a vote. That being the case, if we can start with item number two, approval of the minutes of the meetings of May 20th, which the trustees have pleasure.
So moved.
So moved. Is there a second?
Kathy.
Okay, Kathy. Is there a second?
Second.
Mario, I'm sorry, Mark, second it. Is there discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion is properly made and second, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Abstained? All right, we'll put administrative matters on hold for a second. Item four, age annuity, rule of 80, early retirement. Information only, does not require a vote. Is there any questions on item four by the trustees? Item number five, service-connected disability retirement. Again, with a disability retirement, if there's going to be discussion on the individual's physical records, medical records, we'd have to go into executive session. If the trustees have medical records and feel that they can render a vote, so be it.
I had a general question. Has it been going well with Yale Occupational?
I beg your pardon?
I just a general question about whether it's been going well with Yale Occupational.
Yeah, this item number five is like the main one we were waiting on, because this was the gentleman who is still currently working and can really only retire on a disability pension. So, and I know he was seen in January, so this was the main one we were waiting on. I do still have maybe two or three pending with them, but they're re-exams. So they're not waiting, but I've been in communication with them. I actually spoke to them again on the phone yesterday, so hopefully they'll be on next month's agenda.
Good, thanks.
This is Kathy. I've read the medical report, and I'd like to move that we accept his disability pension.
Motion's made. Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second.
Mark Peter-Simon second it. Is there discussion on the motion? In the absence of, a motion has been properly made and second. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? I noticed that the distinguished trustee Zangari has joined the meeting.
Yes, he is.
Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Item number six, disability retirement reexaminations. Again, these are individuals who have already retired. They're receiving a disability retirement, but in accordance with the Act, the Pension Act, it is required that within the first 5 years of their disability retirement, they return for three medical examinations that with our medical consultant to determine if the disability, a debilitating condition has still existed, and if the retirement is to continue on. You have the report, and this is the third reexamination for Patricia Siskowski. This is her last examination that she'll be required to take. What is the board's pleasure on item number six?
Mr. Chair, I move for approval of item number six.
Okay, Trustee Peter-Simon has made a motion to approve the disability retirement. Is there a
Tom
second?
Tom Kim is second it.
Trustee Kim is second it. Is there discussion on the motion? In the absence of, a motion has been properly made and second. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? All right, by virtue of the fact that there's no one opposed and there's no abstentions, it's I know we normally would have each trustee give their name and vote, but I think that serves the same purpose. You think so, Carolyn?
I think it's fine.
Okay. Item number 7, death after retirement, information only. Richard Baer, Bernie Summers. If we can have a moment of silence for the repose of the souls of Richard Baer and Bernie Summers. Thank you. Item 8, payment of bills. Is there a motion to make payment on the bills?
I make a motion to pay the bills.
Mario, Trustee Zangari has made a motion to pay the bills. Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second it.
Trustee Petrosimone has seconded the motion. Is there discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion for property made and second, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstain? Thank you. If we could return back to the agenda. I'm not aware of any old business at this point, unless the trustees have something they would like to discuss. Sometime old business in effect is synonymous with what we discuss under administrative matters, which I think we're going to get to a couple of topics that have been hanging. Is there any new business that the trustees would like to address? Item 10. All right, if not, if we can return to the agenda, item number 3, administrative matters. Our legal team has done an excellent job in soliciting and receiving from the Internal Revenue a favorable ruling on the ability of SERF retirees to enjoy a favorable tax treatment for service-connected disability. Is there anything, any commentary, Carolyn, you'd like to offer for that?
Well, I think Jack.
Jack, I'm sorry, Jack. Well, the both of you, but Jack, carried the ball on this.
Yeah, he really carried the ball on this.
Mike, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks very much. We do have the ruling from the IRS. They looked over the plan with a fine-tooth comb, asked a lot of questions about isn't this a problem or that. Everything was resolved, and the fund has received every ruling that it asked for, so we're very pleased with that. You may recall that this board was asked a while ago to approve an amendment, which was put in. That's one of the things the IRS spotted in looking over the plan carefully, that there were a couple of unions that were inadvertently left out of this benefit, and the board approved an amendment to bring them into it. We have one final housekeeping amendment here. It's a small word change. The IRS noticed that the definition of an in-service disability being a disability incurred in the course of or arising out of and in the course of employment by the city. The correct word is and. There were three places in the plan where it said instead that it's arising out of or in the course of employment. So we needed to change those ors to and, which matches the Workers' Compensation Act. We are taking the definitions out of the Workers' Compensation Act and out of the city ordinances that copied the definition in that act. And the tax-free nature of the benefit flows from a conclusion by the IRS that this benefit is, quote, in the nature of workers' compensation or is the equivalent of workers' compensation. So this is just a conforming amendment. You should have received it in connection with the materials. And we're going to propose that this conforming amendment to the plan be adopted in accordance with the IRS request. I know that Leanna has been working very hard in trying to implement this ruling. It's a big job. and you know, the funds records were not entirely set up to accommodate this ruling. So there's a lot to do and a lot of communications to be made, both with the pensioners and with the survivors of deceased disability pensioners, to inform them of the ruling. Some of them will have already filed for 2019. We did manage to get it retroactive to 2019. Those who have already filed will be eligible for refunds. Those who have not yet filed in view of the COVID July 15 deadline need to be apprised that there will be an amendment to their 1099-R form so that this benefit will be tax-free. So I will entertain any questions, and we could proceed perhaps to an amendment that will adopt the conforming language to the plan. The unions, of course, also need to be apprised of this.
Jack?
Is there a motion to accept the alterations to the language to accommodate the Internal Revenue ruling?
I make that motion.
Motion made by Trustee Zangari. Is there a second to the motion?
Tom Kim, a second.
Is there discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion properly made and second, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstained?
Jerry, when does this take effect?
It's retroactive. Retroactive to January 1, 2019. So any benefits received after the beginning of last year will be eligible for this benefit.
So therefore, an employee would have to like readjust their income tax statement for last year. Is that how it works?
If they've already filed for 2019, yes, they can apply for a refund.
Okay, good job. Thank you.
This is Leanne Ambersley. I just want to add, because, again, this is a huge project. It's going to take some time, so it can't just be somebody can just go and ask for the amendment right now, because all of last week and so far of this week already, it's taken me and my staff to actually just compile the list of the people who are eligible for this benefit. We had the actuary help us, and I ran my own report through Northern Trust. It just is difficult because it's basically every single person who's ever retired on a service-connected disability, and it's not always been recorded in our Northern Trust system if it's service-connected or non-service-connected, and this benefit is only for service-connected. So we compiled a list of, I think it was about 305 employees that could potentially have this. That doesn't mean they do, but they were ones that we weren't quite sure about, or we knew they had disability but didn't know what kind of disability. So all last week and this week, we basically spent pulling those 305 files. We have maybe 30 more. Then we'll, you know, shorten it down to a smaller list. I'm thinking the actual list, though, might be around 150 people or so, give or take. So hopefully by tomorrow we'll have the final list, but then the actual process starts of implementing it to those 150 people. So, you know, we have to go in and change it going forward for all 150 people. And then we have to, in order to do a retro, there's a form. We cannot do it. Only Northern Trust can. So there is a form that we will have to fill out for each 150 people telling Northern Trust that, you know, the action we want them to take for all of 2019 and the amount of months of 2020 that we've missed so far. So it is going to take time before all of these are completed. So I have a feeling, I mean, I am hoping we will get it done before the next meeting, but most likely people probably already will have filed their taxes. So most likely the majority of them will probably all have to refile. And I know Jack is working on a letter, I think, to send to labor relations to give to the unions, and then also a letter that we'll be mailing out to these however many 150 or so people, notifying them of this.
Right.
Well, I like to take this opportunity on behalf of the collective bargaining units in the city of New Haven, the SERF plan, to express our gratitude to the trustees for securing this favorable tax treatment, because it's a major thing economically. Yep. As you know, if an employee now retires, or from 2019 forward retires from SERF with a service-connected disability, there's a significant tax favorable treatment here in terms of whatever their salary was in the year that they became disabled. 50% of that will become exempt from taxes every year thereafter. So if a person left and was making $70,000, $35,000 of their normal pension benefit that would be taxable will now become exempt from taxes. That's a significant benefit to these employees. And I'd like to especially thank Mayor Olicker, because when this issue came up, he immediately mobilized labor relations and asked them to interact with our office to try to get this thing fast-tracked, which helped us immensely. So thank you, Mayor, for your input on that.
I appreciate it. I don't really do anything. I think the thanks goes to the staff and the attorneys for bringing this to the attention of everyone and making sure that we knew about this opportunity for our employees and retirees.
Well, really, the thanks goes to Jerry, who came up with this idea and asked the question, well, why, if police and fire get this benefit, don't our SERF employees? And then we looked into it. So I think it was a team effort here.
Yep, no doubt about it. All hands are on deck.
Good job.
Okay. Item B under administrative matters. There's a 1.7% COLA increase, which will become effective in the pension benefits issue from July 1, 2020. Our actuary does that in accordance with the plan requirements. They use a federal consumer table to calculate what the rise of the cost of living has been, and it was determined it's 1.7%. Again, this is information only, but if the trustees have any questions, you can pose them now. If not, item C, this, I think we've touched on this in the issue before on the disability, but an update on the Yale Occupational. I know that there was some, it was voiced at the last meeting or the meeting before that we were having some difficulty with Yale Occupational, our medical consultant to the plan, where there was, we were not receiving in a timely manner medical reports for police and fire and SERF funds. We had Dr. Redlich appear before the trustees, and we articulated our disenchantment with that, and she had assured us that there was going to be a correction to that, and we would see that. Leon, you want to give more commentary on that?
That was mainly kind of the update I wanted to give was we did obviously receive the main one that we were waiting on for SERF. And the one re-exam, there are still, like I said, two more that should definitely, I should have already received for this meeting, because I was told that the reports were ready in April, just waiting to be signed. I spoke to them by phone yesterday, so I'm hoping 100% I'll be getting them within the next couple of days, so they'll be on the next month's meeting.
Okay. Any further questions on the issue at Yale Occupational? I think they're in line now.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But we will keep a pulse on it, and we'll let you know what's going on. Because those medical reports are critical. I think we've exhausted administrative matters. I think we can return to item one, which was the investment report, and turn it over to our eminent financial consultants.
Morning. Thank you, Jerry. I'd like to start, so as Leanna mentioned earlier, we have Fairview Capital presenting in about a half an hour. So I just wanted to run through the investment report prior, because I know that's very important. So Leanna, if you could pull up the report that said May 2020.
May 2020, June SERF. This one, Derek?
That's the one.
Okay.
Nice. Okay, so again, bear in mind, you know, here we are, June 17th, and, you know, a lot has happened since May 31st, but nonetheless, this just shows what the different indices have done quarter to date, year to date, and then, you know, rolling 1 year and 3 year. And as you can see, you know, depending on what sector in the market you are in, the returns vary greatly. You know, namely, if you look at 1 year return for Russell 1000 growth, which is large cap growth, that was up 26. Russell 1000 value, which is large cap value, was down 1.64. So huge dispersions depending on where you were in the marketplace. You know, the trustees have done a good job of adding to large cap growth over the last several months. So that certainly helped the portfolio kick it into high gear during this, you know, roughly 40 or 50 day rally. So that's done very, very, very positive effects for your portfolio to get you back close to where you were prior to the COVID crisis. And then obviously you go down the capitalization scale, mid cap, small cap. You know, there's not a lot of return there, and some of it's still negative on the value side, namely. Leanna, if you could go to the next page. Can I control this, Leanna, or is this just you?
I think you could. If you shared it, I think you could. I don't think you can control it if I shared it.
Okay, I just feel bad asking it. Okay.
That's okay.
All right. Moving on, and somehow I made this smaller on my screen. I don't know why. Sorry. We're looking for now. Okay. So this shows you the SURF composite, the top blue line. So that's the total funds back up to 172 million. That's again helped because of our large cap stance. Our mid cap has done well, but you know, we have very, very little small cap. We reduced small cap exposure proactively prior to COVID. So that was good. Mid cap we reduced during COVID, which was also good. Large cap, we had a good amount of money in large cap value, but we've added substantial money to large cap growth. So as you can see, for the 1 year, we are at 7.86%. That's great. You know, we'll see if this year continues. The fiscal year ends in, you know, half a month. So hopefully we can continue. You know, intra-month June did have one of the largest single day pullbacks. I think we had just under a 6% pullback in 1 day. So we'll see what happens here. Moving forward, but we think that if this rally continues, hopefully we can hit that 7.75% target for the fiscal year. Yes.
So that money was deployed after the downturn in the market, right? The large cap money.
Correct. So basically, we got full effect of the, you know, upswing. So that's been great. It's helped
fantastic.
Out.
Fantastic.
Pardon?
I said great job. Fantastic.
Thank you. So thank you. So. Yeah, it's better to be lucky than good. So, so moving on, lead to the next page.
Sure.
So we show some international equity still down. We see some potential opportunity there. Long term, short term, we're still biased to domestic equities. Fixed income, you can see, has done well. Our fixed income's up 1 year, just under 10%. Last year, you know, last calendar year, we also had a very good year with our fixed income, if you guys remember. But again, this year that theme held on, and we have some commentary about what the Fed's been saying and the liquidity in the market, and basically zero or near zero interest rates for, you know, some people are thinking well into 2022 for various reasons, deflationary trends, things of that nature. So easy fiscal policy, you know, low rates, a lot of liquidity in the market. This all is very, very positive for, you know, risk assets or stocks. Moving on, Lee, please.
Yep.
I think that's it, actually. Okay, there we go. So we just show our private equity and hedge funds and cash. So all fairly stable. We should be getting valuations, you know, end of probably July for our June valuation. So that those numbers should all be updated by the end of July, maybe August. So that will hopefully add another tailwind to the performance. So that's what we have for the. So all in all, we think the portfolio looks good. Leanne, if you could go to the next page.
Hey, Derek, before you move on, Fairview Capital, they would be put into the private equity space, correct?
Correct.
And where would they fall? So we got this open, we're looking at how much are they asking for us to invest with them?
Well, yeah, just to get, we talked about it briefly last month, but just to remind everybody, Fairview Capital, when we interviewed Alkeon for their innovations fund, I don't know if you folks recall, those of you who were here, Alkeon had an innovations fund, which is a venture capital. So within private equity, there's various strategies depending on where you are in the cycle of a private equity firm. Venture capital, as you folks probably remember, is pretty early stage development of companies. Alkeon is very much focused on technology and AI, and I think there was ultimately a $10 million allocation for VC. Five was awarded to Alkeon, and five was awarded to Fairview Capital's Emerging Managers Fund that they were going to create for City of New Haven. And Fairview Capital, the representative contacted us at Raymond James probably about 2 months ago and brought it to our attention that during COVID, they're having a very difficult time creating that fund just because the opportunity set was not as robust as they hoped it would be for all the obvious reasons, not a lot of business getting done. So Fairview Capital has been in business for a very long time. They have a very long-standing track record. They're very good fund located here in West Hartford, Connecticut. So they asked that they would be able to present their legacy fund product, which is a fund-to-fund VC, traditional VC fund. So that's what they're going to talk about today. The point of that is just, unfortunately they weren't able to get that emerging managers fund off the ground because of the economic climate that we're in. So ultimately they were awarded $5 million for their other product that they presented. So they had asked that, could they present for that same $5 million sleeve just with their legacy product that's been up and running.
Derek, just for a refresher, did we set aside the $5 million for them?
Well, we have cash, so that's always an opportunity, or there could always be a reallocation if needed.
Were they charging us for that allocation?
No.
Okay, thank you.
The fund didn't even exist yet, Tom. It wasn't a fund that was open.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, if you could flip slide.
All right.
That just shows how the assets are broken down. We don't need to spend a lot of time there. Next slide, please. That's just a visual. So what this shows is your current allocation versus your policy. Obviously, we have to mind your investment policy index. When we deviate from the policy, it's okay. We just need to make you aware of where your deviation is and by how much. Deviation from the policy gives you, deviation from policy returns. So what that means, Leanne, if you could flip back to the first page.
Sure.
I think it was this, forgot what page number. Sorry. Oh. Like way back to the beginning. One more, I think, right there. So just to put that in perspective, as you can see under the top line, that's the actual SURF fund. The two lines under them, so you have the asset allocation policy index and then the composite benchmark. Just to remind everybody, that policy index is exactly what we were just looking at. So that's if the fund were invested in index funds exactly the way the investment policy states, those would be your returns. So the deviations from the policy is what gives you excess returns or in some years, less returns. And then the composite SURF composite benchmark is, just to remind everybody what that is, that's the fund's current allocation if it was 100% passive. So if you had everything allocated exactly the same way SURF has been allocated, just passively managed without active management. And that's what those numbers are. And again, some years they're better, some years they're worse. But it just goes to show you some outperformance, underperformance, just puts it all into perspective for you. Okay, we started. Flip you around. Can you go back to the page after we were just looking at the policy? I think it was like four or five pages down.
Give me 1 second. I lost. Sorry, guys.
No problem.
It's all minimized. I'm trying to find it.
That happened to me, too.
Hold on.
Oh.
I'm going to bring it back. Harder on a laptop. Mm-hmm.
Anybody have any questions in the meantime while we're looking?
Okay. What page? Back to the graph?
10. So again, this just shows the current policy index versus our current allocation. Not a huge deviation. Just, you obviously underweight international equity, which has helped. Slightly overweight U.S. fixed income, which has helped, because U.S. fixed income has done well. So it just goes to show you some of the deviation. Nothing we need to spend a lot of time on. You can flip to the next page or the page after. Again, this just shows it in way of, pie chart form. It doesn't really change much. You can go to the next page. This just shows the change of the fund over time. Some of it's organic because of market compressions and or expansions, and some of it's been tactical changes. So it just shows you visually, it's kind of a nice chart to look at, just to show you some of the trends that have happened. Okay, Leanna, if you could go to the next page. This just shows performance over time in a bar chart versus the asset allocation policy index again. As you can see, we've done a good job of outperforming on the upside and outperforming on the downside. So the key to kind of what we do here is, when things are good, we want to make money, hopefully more money than passive. But more importantly, in our opinion, when things are down, lose less money because you have more money. The compounding effect of losing less money gives you more money to compound out at when things turn around and get better. So all good metrics.
Just for my clarification, today we're down 217?
Yeah.
And the benchmark's down 613.
Correct. The policy benchmark, yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Next page, Lee. Okay, this just shows the current allocation. It's nice to see this just because, I know we talk about large dollars and large denominations. We talk about $10 million like we talk about, $5. And obviously $10 million is a lot of money. But when you put it into the overall size of the fund, you can see the fund is very well diversified. So it's good to look at it that way and just to, give everybody peace of mind. We're talking, very, very large dollars amounts of dollars. A lot of people's livelihoods are, at play here, and we all take that very seriously, obviously. But this just goes to show how well the fund is diversified. So the more diverse, typically, ultimately the better things do when things get a little hectic. And we've done a good job of diversifying. Next page, please. And that's it. All right. So that's all we have for performance. I have some market commentary, which I wouldn't mind saving till the end. So at least I know Merrill Oaker needs to hop off early. If you want to at least let Fairview come in. Lee, are they available?
I told them to join at 9 because normally our meetings went to 9:30. So
let me see if I could reach out to her.
Yeah, and
just to get them on early because I think I'd like to at least get the presentation done and find Michelle's phone number. Bear with me a minute. I think I have it right here. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to mute myself for 1 minute. Just call them. I wasn't able to get the number.
I can send you an email.
Okay. Hold on. Let me try one more time. Okay, I reached Michelle, the representative at Fairview. She's going to round up the group and get them to call in.
Okay, great.
So that's good. Are there any other questions or anything while we wait?
Derek, do you want to talk about the market commentary while we're waiting?
I could. If you want to pull up that the other thing that says SURF June 2020.
Sure. Let's see. Screen share. Have it minimized.
Okay, great. So again, this is just, as of June 11th, today's June 17th, things change very, very quickly. But I wanted to get the most updated report that we had. The only thing I wanted to highlight on here is this report just talks about what's going on in the market short term and what, technically and fundamentally is going on in the market. Ultimately, if you look at that third paragraph there, talking about pullbacks within the market, there was a few, but not many. But we see a longer term opportunity here because of the enormous fiscal and monetary response. So we feel that that's outweighed the potential negatives, all the different things that are going on, trade rhetoric, the virus, assuming, nothing changes with the virus. Election things moving on. If you go to the next page, Lee, please. So this just talks about macroeconomic things. So we look at, as I mentioned earlier, inflationary, and we're actually have deflationary pressures on the right. You can see that blue line. So the Fed, when they make interest rate decisions, they look to fight inflation. But the thing that scares the Fed more than anything in the world is deflation. So they are going to keep as much stimulus as they can in the market to fight deflationary pressures, because that's probably the worst possible scenario for the Fed. So we see, again, as I mentioned earlier, lower for longer. Rates will stay low. There'll be economic stimulus. The Fed just announced, I think yesterday, the day prior, they're going to start buying some other risk assets. This is an enormous amount of fiscal stimulus added to the market, which has really never been seen in the amount of the amount and the timeliness of how quickly it's been done. So a few things that have been learned over the years is, you just can't fight the Fed. When the Fed, basically, they have an open checkbook and they start buying assets and keeping rates low, you just have to get behind it. It's a huge, huge tailwind. Next page. Thank you. So this just talks about earnings and valuations. So from a fundamental standpoint, we see some, there were huge valuation expansions. So now we need earnings to kind of kick in. That'll be like phase two of what's going to keep these stocks moving forward. And we see that we feel we've troughed in earnings expectations through COVID crisis. Again, this can change at any given point, in any given time, assuming there are no downside surprises with the spread of the virus. There was an article I read yesterday that, down in Florida, they opened up some of the bars, I think a week or so ago, and they did see, again, it's hard to discern whether the media is using the right verbiage, but I've heard spikes in COVID outbreaks back down in Florida in the bar scene. If that's the case, that will certainly potentially, dampen any type of further opening. So a lot is depending on how this thing comes about. Still a lot of unknowns. We're still in uncharted waters. We hope and pray that things are going to continue in a downward trend. But we just don't know. Next page, Leanne, please. So this top chart just shows, when you look at things fundamentally, basically earnings per share, PEs, things of that nature. And then there's a way of looking at things just technically. What do charts do? There are buying programs, computer buying programs. And you can see that technical short term up on the top. There's a technical short term pullback that was you know, obviously a very large pullback in one single day. But those are good. I mean, you know, nobody really wants to feel, you know, a drop like that in a day or two. But ultimately, you know, 6, 7, 8% pullback. We talked about this last month. Those are all very healthy and very good to help the market somewhat regroup and then ultimately trend higher. So that's healthy. We hope it continues. It's not going to feel good, but we just hope it doesn't continue before June 30. We want to finish out the fiscal year strongly. And yeah, that's basically all I have. There's a couple more charts. If you could go two more slides, Leanna, please. Technical small caps. One of the things we want to say here is that, you know, one of the areas of the domestic market that we've stayed away from that is starting to show a little bit of promise is small caps. You know, we think that small caps, we need to see the breadth of this market. When we talk about market breadth, we want to see all sectors and asset classes in the market trend higher. That's a healthy, robust recovery. Right now, it's been very specific, namely large cap, namely very large cap growth, very select sectors, namely healthcare, technology, things of that nature, consumer discretionary. As that the market continues to move forward, we hope to see that breadth continue and expand. So we think it might be soon time to start adding to small cap stocks. We have a very small allocation. We have a very good manager there. So I'm comfortable adding to it when the time makes sense. We just don't think we're there yet, but should the opportunity arise, that would probably be our next equity tweak recommendation. You know, as the last tweak was go up capitalization from small mid-cap stocks to large-cap stocks, namely large-cap growth. We would look, if this thing continues to trend in the right direction, we would namely say, hey, it might be time to start adding to our small-cap exposure. So ultimately, that's what we see. No changes as of yet that we see. There's nothing ultimately there that we need to be concerned about. We just hope that things continue to go well the way they've been going.
Derek, they're in the waiting room.
Okay, great. So without further ado, so again, Fairview Capital, you've all met them a few times before, a lot of you here. I want to turn the floor over to them. So Michelle Chow-Tai, who do we have here? Leanna?
They're joining now. Alan.
I have to hop off. Thanks, everyone. Keep up good work.
Good morning.
Thanks, bye-bye. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Michelle, nice to connecting to audio. I see that. Hi, Michelle, you there?
She just has to unmute herself. Yeah, the bottom left. There you go.
There we are.
Hi, Michelle. So we've discussed, you know, a lot of the trustees here that you see here were here when you folks first presented a while back. We welcome you back to the table. We've set the stage for, you know, obviously just to remind everybody who you folks are, what transpired in the past. And we're happy to have you back. And without further ado, we'd like to turn the table over to Michelle. And want to introduce your group and take over the presentation.
Sure. Thank you for that, Derek. Good morning, everybody. I'm actually going to have Kola Olifinboba, our managing partner at Fairview, take it from here.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Derek. Good morning. My name is Kola Olifinboba, and I'm a managing partner at Fairview Capital. We're a private equity investment management firm headquartered in West Hartford, Connecticut. And I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Michelle Chow-Tai, who heads our business development, and Alan Matamana, who is also a partner at the firm. First, we want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to present to you again. We also want to thank you for the allocation you had previously made to our Next Generation Manager Fund, which, due to a variety of factors beyond our control, we now believe it will take us longer to raise than previously anticipated. We appreciate your consideration to move the allocation to our best-in-class venture capital fund of funds, Fairview Private Markets Fund 5, which has already closed on capital from other investors and will be the focus of the discussion today. If you join me on page 3 of the presentation you have, here are brief biographies on the three of us. We have more complete biographies of our entire investment team in the appendix.
Hey, Cola, may I interrupt? Hey, Leanna, do you have the presentation up so the trustees can see it, or did you email it to them? Or
I thought Michelle did.
Yeah,
I'm happy to share. Do a screen share if that's helpful.
Do you have a copy, right? Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's okay. Do you need to have it, Derek?
There we go. No, I just wanted Leanna to share it with the group so everybody has it right on their screen there.
Okay,
perfect. Yeah, so I'll advance the slides, Cole, as we go on.
Okay, perfect. I'll go to page 3.
Thank you.
So on this page is the bios of Michelle, Alan, and myself. So we'll each introduce ourselves briefly. To talk by way of early background, I grew up in Nigeria. I have lived in Connecticut now for the better part of the last 30 years. This is my 14th year at Fairview, where I help lead the firm strategically and across our investment and other functions. Prior to joining Fairview, I was a management consultant at McKinsey's Boston office, where I worked with clients in healthcare and in private equity. I am a physician by training, and earlier in my career had trained and then practiced medicine on the faculty of the University of Connecticut at the Health Center in Farmington. I'll now have Alan and Michelle introduce themselves briefly.
Hi, good morning, everyone, and thank you also for the opportunity to present today. My name is Alan Matamana. I'm a partner at Fairview and have been with the firm now for some 12 years. I started my career studying chemical engineering at Princeton and quickly joined McKinsey in their Silicon Valley office after graduating, where I started to consult for technology startups. And that began a 20-year-plus career in the venture capital and entrepreneurship space. I joined a venture capital firm called Polaris Partners in their Boston office, where I invested with early-stage tech companies. And over my years there, I then transitioned to the medtech, med device space and moved out to their West Coast office as well. I joined Fairview in 2009 and am a member of our investment team based in West Hartford, Connecticut. I'll turn it over to Michelle.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I'm Michelle Chow Tai. Delighted to be here with you this morning. Thank you for having us. I joined Fairview about 5 years now, back in July of 2015. Prior to that, I worked at TIAA, where I was responsible for their largest and most complex institutional investors. And prior to that, I spent 22 years at HSBC, working in global banking and markets across asset classes and business lines, working with institutional clients as well.
So Alan, if you move to page 4. So at Fairview, we invest in private markets with a particular emphasis on strategies that reflect the future. We'll share more detail as we go along, but suffice to say that our investments are driven by innovation and research and diversity. Alan, page 5. So we're an independent SEC-registered firm and have been that since our founding 26 years ago. We manage almost 30 customized accounts and fund of funds on a discretionary basis with about $9.7 billion of assets under management since inception. Our investment process is time-tested and has demonstrated consistently successful results. Our team is seasoned and multi-generational. We are fully embedded in the private market ecosystem, serving on over 50 advisory boards. And our commitment to our investors is to provide not just superior risk-adjusted returns, but the highest quality client service in the asset class. Alan, page 6, thank you. And here's our face page of our investment team. The two individuals at the top left, Larry Moss and Joan Price, are the founders of the firm. They had come together in 1994 to found Fairview after being practitioners in the private equity space for 10 to 15 years before that. They are both graduates of Howard University. And in fact, Larry is the incoming chair of the Howard University Board of Trustees. They are both pioneers in the private equity industry, particularly in helping to cultivate and nurture many of the most successful diverse private equity firms in the country. Our other partner, Cynthia Tsang, is an applied mathematician by training and joined us over 10 years ago after spending several years as an investment banker at JP Morgan. Our sixth partner, Akav Ashani, joined the firm 12 years ago. We were his second job out of college, and he's built his career at Fairview, stepping back at one point to go to business school at Kellogg and choosing to come back to vest his career here. He's our newest partner and now heads up our San Francisco office. One thing that's immediately obvious on this page is the ethnic, racial, and gender diversity at the firm. Less obvious, but also very important to us, is the experiential and expertise diversity. So we have economists, we have accountants, we have engineers, we have mathematicians. I say we even have a reformed physician with backgrounds in direct investing, management consulting, investment banking, etc. All this leads to a cognitive diversity that helps us make better business and investment decisions on behalf of our clients. Page 7 has our in-house finance, accounting, and compliance team. It is similarly diverse, accomplished, and tenured at the firm. A couple of examples. Our chief compliance officer, Christoph Floyd, has been with Fairview for 15 plus years now. John Barry, a senior accountant at Fairview, has been with us over 20 years. And it goes on and on. You know, people with different backgrounds who have chosen to vest their careers at Fairview, ultimately for the benefit of our clients. On page 8, we truly believe that this diversity makes us a better firm. And we have a graphical representation here that just demonstrates it numerically. Over 60% of our team is female. Over 50% are ethnic minorities, typically underrepresented in private equity. We believe our team is as diverse as you will find, not just in private equity, but in the financial services industry writ large. We extend this to our service providers, including audit, compliance, legal, etc., and we work with excellent firms and practitioners in each of these areas. Next, I'll hand over to Alan to continue the presentation.
Great. So, you know, on the next page, you'll see that we're really proud of our commitment to sustainability and ESG. And this directly flows from the mission and values that every Fairview member commits to. And as you see on the page, the commitment covers both our organization as well as extend to the investments that we make. At the organizational level, it's part of our DNA. Everything from our conservation efforts, our commitment to diversity that Kola mentioned, to our community service. So as an example, every member at Fairview, from the front desk receptionist to the managing partners of the firm, are deeply involved with local nonprofit community causes, causes that the firm in turn supports. At the investment level, we have an ESG policy. It directs our investment and operational due diligence processes. We have a list of areas in which we simply will not invest, which you see listed. And all of these are formalized in a number of different avenues, including the ESG policy, our compliance manual, the code of ethics, employee handbook. So we pay a lot of attention to this topic. On the next page is an overview of the private equity investment solutions we offer at Fairview. So highlighted in orange on the left is our core flagship platform. This is our venture capital program, which we'll go into much more depth today. It includes the full spectrum of venture from early stage all the way through late stage, as well as some select growth equity exposure as well. It's focused on best in class, difficult to access, tenured firms. We also do a number of other things for our clients. We offer a next generation investment platform, which the industry sometimes refers to as emerging managers, that accesses newer funds, smaller funds, and diverse funds. We also do co-investing alongside our managers directly into portfolio companies on a selective basis. And finally, we have a legacy asset management program that takes over large latent cycle funds and manages them out to liquidity. I'll next double click on our venture capital program, which has been and continues to be a core franchise for us. We've been in the venture capital investment business now for some 21 years. We access that asset class on behalf of some 30 institutional clients, and we've made $2.1 billion in commitments to venture capital funds over that span. And that's really a core group of some 25 capital relationships. Those are relationships that we've backed over the last 20 plus years across different market cycles, and that translates to approximately 190 discrete partnership investments. Our program, our venture capital program, has a singular focus on returns. And happy to report, we've consistently outperformed the industry benchmarks. And we've done that across market cycles, and we'll get into performance details shortly. The way we've achieved that, though, is first continuing to access those longstanding tenured managers who've outperformed consistently and who historically have not been open to new investors. And secondly, we also identify the best new next generation or emerging managers. But our biggest asset, as Kola mentioned, is our experience and diverse team. Our partners average some 15 years together, making it one of the most cohesive and stable teams in the industry. On this page, we describe some of the reasons why we feel venture capital is an attractive asset class, with the caveat that it has to be accessed appropriately. And for us, you know, the reasons really begin with performance. So the Fairview experience shows that if you're backing the best venture firms in the industry, you will consistently outperform not just the venture asset class, but almost any other asset class over the long term. And critically, this is true across market cycles, including in times of significant disruption, such as which we're seeing today. As an example, our programs generated very strong returns in and around the last financial crisis, and we'll present those numbers in a couple of pages. But we're capitalizing on incredible trends, including the ongoing innovation in this country, the fact that companies are choosing to stay private longer, the fact that it's cheaper than ever to start companies, and entire sectors continue to be disrupted by companies focused on new and emerging technologies, things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, cybersecurity, Internet of Things. In biotech, which is about 20-30% of our exposure, it's things like gene editing, digital health, bioinformatics. And venture remains critical to the birth of these game-changing companies. And last but not least, the best venture firms have learned from the past. So they deliberately keep their fund sizes small. And what that means is access for investors becomes one of the bigger issues. And this, of course, is one of the problems that Private Markets Fund 5 seeks to solve for our clients. So here we describe the Fairview approach to investing in venture. So for our flagship venture capital funds, which is what we're talking to you about today, the vast majority of exposure will come from these tenured firms that you see on the left of the page. So these are highly experienced groups, strong long-term track records that are very hard to access. They include firms like Kleiner Perkins, which just raised their 19th fund, Bessemer, which is one of the oldest venture firms in the country, Battery, which has raised 12 funds now, all of which have been first or second quartile. So again, expect the vast majority of exposure to come from these best-in-class tenured firms that we've had long-standing relationships with. But we're also constantly refreshing our perspective on the venture environment and making sure we're participating with the best newer funds. And then we take a thesis-based approach. So as an example, in the last cycle, when we saw the rise of the New York venture ecosystem, we identified Greycroft as a market leader in that space. We saw major shifts in the way healthcare venture was being deployed, and so accessed Third Rock Ventures in that space. Similarly, Spark within digital media. And all those investments were made out of our emerging manager programs initially. But Greycroft has now become impossible to access. Third Rock, arguably the best biotech venture firm in the country. Spark has been 3 to 4 times oversubscribed. And so we've transitioned those relationships to our flagship venture fund of funds. But we couldn't have done that if we hadn't gotten to those firms early with large allocations, which is what we were able to do with our emerging manager programs.
Hey, Alan?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you know what the rough breakdown is of these various silos, percentage-wise, of the fund?
So I would expect over 80% of exposure to come from these tenured firms that you see on the far left. The newer firms, you know, in a portfolio of 15 to 20, which is what we aim to build, I would project maybe 1 to 2 newer firms in any given fund cycle. And then the institutional quality seed, which is seed investments are, as you know, the earliest part of the venture value chain. They tend to be smaller funds. Because of the way those funds work in a portfolio construction setting, we will take one typical investment and carve that up 3 to 4 different ways to access seed funds. And that's proportionate with where the exposure is in the industry. But to reiterate, over 80% is going to come from these tenured, hard to access, longstanding relationships that we've had.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. On the next page, you see we've been able to participate in some of the venture industry's biggest successes. You know, one of the characteristics of venture, particularly in technology, is that an outsized portion of the industry's returns are captured by the number one or number two category leaders. It's this winner-take-all dynamic, and it happens in several subsegments within technology. So one way we validate our model is to question, are we building exposure to these market leaders? And as you can see, indeed we are. Over the last few years, we've accessed some of the most successful venture-backed IPOs and acquisitions, including names you'll recognize like Roku, Uber, Snapchat, Zoom, Pinterest. And this doesn't include our historical wins, such as Twitter, Facebook, Tesla, etc. And as you can see from the multiples in the middle of the page, we're getting into these companies very early. Zoom, which we're all using today, generated an over 200x return for us, as an example. That investment alone returned the entire fund of funds in which it was in. And you see on the bottom, the pipeline of existing companies in the Fairview portfolio that are not liquid yet are equally high impact. Names like Airbnb, SpaceX, Stripe, and Coinbase. And what we're most proud of is we're accessing these companies even though we're building these smaller, high conviction portfolios of fund investments. Despite that concentrated approach, we're getting into 6 to 8 of the top 10 venture outcomes in any given year. I'll turn it over to Michelle to go through the specifics on performance.
Thank you for that, Alan. So if you join me on page 16, this page is the venture capital returns we've been able to generate for our LPs through our commingled and single client funds over the last 14 years, going all the way back to 2006. As we noted below, there has been additional fund commitments that are early in their development. And at this point, we've called about 50% of capital. So their performance is obviously not meaningful at this time. But let's review the funds that are on this page. So the first one, Ventures 3, is our commingled venture fund where we have multiple clients. Constitution 3, 4, and 5 is the venture capital funds that we run for the state of Connecticut. We do all of the state of Connecticut venture investing. In fact, we've been doing this for over a decade now for them. Capstone 1 and 2 on this page. Someone have a question? Okay. Capstone 1 and 2 are programs we did for the state of New Jersey. New York Fairview EM Fund is for New York City Retirement System. And the Special Opportunities Fund for 2011 and 2015 were done with the state of Florida. So the headline here is when you look at the net IRR, DPI, and TBPI columns of any of these funds, you'll see that we've been able to consistently generate mid to high teens net IRR. And in some cases, they've been over 20% in net IRR. The TBPIs are in the 2 to 3 ranges, and in many cases, over 2.5 to 3 times net of all fees. The results have been consistent outperformance. Every number listed here is net of all fees. So this is what goes to our LPs, and we're incredibly proud of that. We have a select number of funds on the right side of the page. To give you a sense of the kind of relationships that we have.
Ms. Olafibova, I said it correctly.
Just call me Kola.
Okay,
oh, Kola. That's Michelle speaking. That's Michelle.
Michelle. I'm sorry, Michelle. I just read it wrong. What fund are you proposing for our fund so we could focus in on that also?
Sure. That's Private Markets Fund 5. We're going to go into more details on that. We're just giving you the historical performance right now.
Okay, thank you.
And so on the next page, page 17, this is the fund that we're proposing to you. It's the overview. It's an overview of our newest fund, Private Markets Fund 5. It's the next iteration of our commingled venture program. Here we're targeting $2 billion in commitments.
$200 million.
$200 million in commitments, and in a nutshell, it's this fund will continue our strategy and approach to top-tier investing in venture capital and growth equity funds, fulfilling some of the best practices Alan and Kola talked about that we've developed since inception. It's going to be a high conviction portfolio. We're targeting about 15 to 20 of the best venture capital and growth equity funds over a 3 to 4 vintage year period. This fund will be appropriately diversified by industry, by sector, by vintage year. And as part of the strategy, we have the ability to allocate up to 20% to co-investments and secondaries in the event we see something interesting. And so with that, I'll pass it on to Cola.
So on page 18, we have pipeline and fund construction for private markets fund five. We have already closed on a little bit over $35 million and have begun to invest and commit capital. So you actually get to see many of the firms that will be in the portfolio. It's not a blind portfolio, as is often the case when we raise this fund. The partnerships highlighted with the orange broken lines are the ones we've already committed to. And just to highlight a couple of examples, Kleiner Perkins is one of the most storied firms in Silicon Valley. They founded companies like AOL, Amazon, Electronic Arts, Google, Snap, Twitter, and Uber, to mention some. Third Rock Ventures, which Alan had alluded to as the leading biotechnology venture capital fund in the country, they identify areas of unmet medical need, and then they create companies, de novo, to solve those problems. A couple of examples, they formed a company in their offices called Global Blood Therapeutics. Now, this company has developed the most promising treatment for sickle cell disease in the last 30 years. It's now a $4 billion publicly traded company. Another company they formed, Foundation Medicine, creates unique genomic profile for individual cancers, so facilitating more targeted, less toxic treatments for cancers. This company was purchased by Roche and was also a multi-billion dollar exit for investors in Third Rock. Third Rock's last fund was 5 times oversubscribed, impossible to access, but we've built relationships with them and we've been investing with them since their second fund and continue to do that on a go-forward basis. So as illustrated by these examples, these funds are leaders in information technology and healthcare, life science, venture capital investing, driving transformation in their areas of focus. They're difficult to access, and their relationships we've nurtured and cultivated over the last 20 plus years. We have a pipeline of other leading firms on the same page that we've invested with historically, who we believe will be coming back to market over the investment period of Fairview Private Markets and Fund 5, and they'll go through our diligence process to decide whether they make it in the portfolio or not. So this is the end of our formal presentation. We have additional detail on our due diligence processes, our full biographies in the appendix. And we thank you again for your time and consideration. And then we'll take any questions that you have.
Yeah, I have a few questions if you don't mind.
Sure.
Yes. What is our overall fee that we'll pay for this investment?
Yes. So the fee for the investment averages 75 basis points per year over the investment period of the fund, which is typical for funds of this nature. It used to be high, actually. At a point, it used to be 100 basis points, but it's come down with the market. But part of the emphasis that Michelle made on when she was sharing the performance, that all of the numbers we give you are net of all fees, including our fees. So to make sure that you see what you expect you to get if we do our jobs properly.
So respectfully, Cola.
Sure.
So your firm will charge us 75 bips, and that's it from your firm, or is there a performance fee on top?
So there's a performance fee, but we have a modest carry of 4% on the fund investments, which are the bulk of this. But it only comes after you've gotten 1.5 times your money back. So there is a significant hurdle to the carried interest.
Fair enough. Okay, and do you have an idea of what the underlying fund, the fund fees are with your companies that you're investing in for us?
The underlying funds, it typically is 2 and 20 is the standard for the market, where they charge a 2% management fee and they charge a 20% carried interest. That's typical for the venture capital marketplace.
Okay. Do you negotiate, you know, a little better, or is that you just have to go with their standard rate?
Invariably, the funds of this caliber are funds they can pick their investors. As I talked about Third Rock, they were about five times oversubscribed. So it's one of those things that people are clamoring.
You're lucky to get in.
Yes, exactly.
Got you. All right. One other question. I know a little bit about this. Is there a tie-in, time period for this? A amount of time that we have to commit to? Because I know they're deploying money for long-term ventures.
Yeah. Yes. So the underlying funds themselves typically have a 10-year life, of 10-year fund life. The typical, what you expect is they deploy the capital over the first 3 to 4 years of that period, and then they're building these companies up, say, over the next couple of years. By the fourth, fifth year, you start to get some of your money back. And so invariably what happens is you're never out of your full commitment. Say you commit, for example, $10 million. By the time they've called $3 or $4 million, you start to get some money back. So net, by the time they fully call your 10, you've probably gotten 4 or 5 back, is how things typically work in this space.
So for my education, so if there's a profit in the fund,
yes,
money funnels back to the pension fund, or do you reinvest it?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Maybe, yeah.
So if it had a 4% return on $4 million, that profit would come back to the fund in cash, or would be reinvested into your fund?
No, it comes back to you, to the investor.
I see.
So any returns, once they've made the commitment and invested in the companies, as those companies get sold, either they go public, through the IPO process, or they get acquired by other companies, which is the typical mode of exit. The proceeds from that come back to us, and we send that right back to you. So that's how it works.
Okay. So then back to the base, the first question: how long is our funds going to be tied up for with your firm?
Yeah, so like I said, the underlying funds have a 10-year period, 10-year life. Our fund has a 12-year life. And the expectation, as Michelle alluded to, is that you will get about 2.5 times what your commitment is if we do our jobs properly over that period.
So that means if we commit to funds today, that money is tied up, respectfully, for 12 years as an industry.
Not exactly, no, which is part of what I was trying to explain. Over 12 years, yes, they will call the capital, but somewhere in that 12-year period, you have started to get money back, as proceeds from the... So you're never out of the amount, they will call that amount, but you already start to get returns back even during that 12-year period.
Okay, but our contract with the money we allocate today is a 12-year contract with you.
That is correct. That is correct.
In the event that you should sell your firm or, 12 years, you decide to retire within that period, is there an exit for the pension fund if we're not happy, with the new successor or things of that nature?
There are typically clauses, that can will be in the contract that would allow if you were unhappy or other investors were unhappy. But ultimately, the capital we call from you, we're not holding it at Fairview. It's going into this, the underlying portfolio. It's going into the companies. So no matter what Fairview ever did, and Fairview's not planning to sell, we plan to be here. But no matter what Fairview ever did, ultimately, you are the beneficial owner of the interests in those companies, in the next generation of those technology companies, those healthcare companies.
You
have an ownership interest.
Today we're investing in Alan, Cola, and Michelle. So, that's in 12 years, we don't know. 12 years, I won't be here. So, anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, this is Jerry Spagnuolo.
Hi, Jerry.
Chairperson. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anybody, and don't take it personal, but I don't like the idea of tying money up for the fund for 12 years. I mean, 20 things can happen. I saw something similar happen with the police and fire fund where they tied an investment up for 10 years and it caused problems. there was a long story associated with that where the financial consultant for the fund became simultaneously an investor of the fund. And at one point that caused the determination of the individual as the financial consultant to the fund. And they wanted to do the same thing with the investment he had. And the attorneys told us, you can't do anything. You're stuck with him because you've tied your money up for 10 years. I mean, so I've seen where things, you know, look rosy at the time that you're proposing things, and they're all good intentions, but I have a sour taste in my mouth already as to what happens when an investment gets tied up for a period of time that's 10 years or longer. And it wasn't a pleasant experience. I mean, Trustee Kim, I think he's asking some point on questions. You know, we're looking at you, your honorable people. No one knows what the future holds. And I mean, I personally don't support taking an investment and tying that money up for 10 years, 12 years. It doesn't sit well with me. Would you be amenable to, in terms of an alternative amount of time?
Go ahead, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one thing worth mentioning here is that, first of all, the terms that Fairview is proposing are really consistent within the private markets, venture all the way through private equity. The other thing worth mentioning, though, is that there are alternative liquidity options in the interim that people can take advantage of if, for any number of reasons, you feel like you want to exit an investment. It could be, you know, liquidity challenges, or you might have a change in strategy down the road. There are secondary markets where you can transact at the fund level as well as the fund of funds level. So all that would happen in that case is that in the city of New Haven's interest would be transitioned to another buyer. Now there is a pricing difference there, right? So there's typically a slight discount to what the asset value is that you would take, but that certainly is an option that, you know, people keep in their back pocket as they think about accessing, you know, the private markets.
Right. So if I may, Alan, just expound upon that, Jerry, there's something called a secondary market. You know, the situation that happened with police and fire was a bit different. Because, you know, the fund itself did not, well, we don't need to get into that, but nonetheless, there are secondary markets. So let's say, you know, some management change happened at Fairview and Cerf was no longer happy with the new management team. Let's just say that's an example. You know, there are secondary markets where you know, we can go out and find a value of the fund and underlying investments ultimately. So there are exit strategies, and to Cola's point earlier.
But why have to go through all that? I mean, is this such an extraordinary investment opportunity that there's no other way that could be replicated with less risk or less tie up on money?
Jerry, this is pretty standard in the industry.
Well, one of the things I could add, Jerry, is, you know, one of the reasons we look at private investments is, as you can see, if you look at your last investment report, you know, we went through a very difficult liquid market cycle, and that's priced every second of the day, and it's very liquid. That's positive and potentially negative for what we're trying to do here. And the positives are for a liquid investment is that it's liquid. If you don't like it, we can say, hey, we don't like it. Let's get out of it. And we sell it. And we're selling it, whatever the market's willing to pay us for it. The nice thing to private investments are when there's a very difficult market cycle, there is no forced selling. There is no marketplace. So there, you know, basically what that does is help smooth out your returns. And with a pension fund, you know, we all know that a lot of things are based off actuarial numbers, you know, fiscal year reports, things of that nature. So if there is an ability to protect some of your money from quote unquote forced selling when panic comes into the market, that's where a private investment makes sense. Now, I'm not sitting here endorsing Fairview saying, hey, they're worth staying in for 12 years. And, you know, and I didn't ask, are there extensions available? Is it, so is it 12 with, you know, a 1 year extension, or what is the structure?
Yes, it could, you could have extensions on the back end, but again, to the point you made about we've on occasion had clients who have taken advantage of the secondary liquidity market and still gotten significant returns from us due to usually their own internal issues. If they've, you know, for example, if things crash in other parts of the market and suddenly they find themselves overweight in private equity, they have taken advantage of secondary options. So it's not, you're not, I mean, it's contractually, it's a, you know, 12-year term, but you have options during that period. If you know it's so, if it makes a difference, you know, to what your program is.
You know, I like this investment opportunity. I like your numbers, your performance, your quality firm. There's no doubt about that. And I'm on board 100%. So I didn't realize till today that we're talking about a 12-year lockup. And I'm just saying that makes me just stop and pause for a minute because, again, everything else is on board, but that's a long period of time to tie up anything. And I was just wondering if there's a way that this opportunity could be extended, but in a shorter tie-up period.
Akola, could I just add to Jerry's question? Because as you were explaining before, that the gains of the fund come back to our pension. So over 10 years, if we invested, just say $5 million, how much, through your experience, do you think will come back to us in that period of time?
Yeah. So in the historical funds that we have invested, you know, similar to this, in that period of time, we would expect you to have gotten anything from $10 to $15 million back on your five, if we've done our jobs properly.
Jerry, that speaks volumes right there.
And I will add that it's very similar in terms of the term to the previous fund that we had presented to you last year, the Next Generation Fund that you had approved. And I remember we had a conversation like this, you know, about the term as well. And I mean, at that time, I think hopefully you were able to get comfortable with the fact that Fairview, we've been around for 26 years. We've worked really hard to build a firm for the ages. You know, we've tried to build an institution. It's very values driven. So we expect to be here for the next 26 years. And, but again, to the extent that your circumstances change for whatever reason, you have options. You're not tied. You always have an option. You can always take advantage of the secondaries market, which is a very developed, you know, market. We hope you don't. We hope this is just the first of multiple investments you make with Fairview. We have clients that have been with us since 1994, you know, not dissimilar from yourselves. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we take pride in as a firm.
So again, just in summation, I hear the trustees' concerns, and you know, obviously, I know the background. I think we all collectively understand why we're in private markets. I think we all understand the benefits. Obviously, the returns are spectacular. You know, ultimately, I don't know if you folks remember, the trustees remember a while back, we showed a slide of what a J curve is. I mean, I perhaps should have shown that. The reason why a lot of these funds need years to invest is, you know, because of the capital call structure. So there's investments made over time. It takes a long time to fund these things for the funds that you're on. You know, again, these are private companies, private funds. It takes time for these things to mature, for the ideas to, you know, basically come to fruition. So I understand, you know, obviously our side of the business, we understand why private investments, we understand length and duration, we understand lockups. But then again, I also understand the sensitivity of the trustees. I have to respect their opinion for the timeliness or the amount of time their money's locked up. And again, you know, it's the old adage that, you know, you do something wrong, they'll tell you, tell three or four people, you do something right, you don't tell anybody. So there was an example with a sister fund with one bad seed. I just don't want to have that spoil the bunch. I mean, we do have currently, just for the trustees' mindset, we do have private investments that have lockups. So we have, we have some real estate funds that we've invested in that have several year commitments. We have another venture capital fund that has several year commitments. We have some private equity.
I'm aware we have lockups.
Right.
What is the longest one we have right now?
I'd have to check back to my notes.
It's not a 10 year, is it?
I don't believe so. I believe the longest lockup we currently have is 8 years, but I can't say that with 100% certainty.
So this is Carol.
Excuse me, Carol.
Sorry.
Jerry, I know we're going to discuss this afterwards, but my question on the investment to COLA is, I know with the funds of funds you're investing in, can you give us an idea of what type of industries? I know, like, you talked about AI and all that, but what is your concentration that you really look for? The other thing is, I know the some of the strategies on the West Coast is invest in a lot of companies and hope you pick one winner, knowing that you're going to lose a lot in that type of investment. So what do you look for in a fund for your fund of funds?
Yes. So we're looking for funds that are expert in their areas of interest, that have networks that are deep, that they have ways of sourcing the best entrepreneurs, the best companies. They have company building abilities, so they're able to help those entrepreneurs build, you know, world-class companies. I think on one of the pages that Alan had presented, there were names like, you know, Uber. We were investors in a fund that invested in Uber when I think Uber was a sub $200 million company, ultimately ended up being a $60, $70 billion exit, you know, for that fund. We're currently investors in Zoom through another one of our funds, which, you know, we're all using right now. We're investors in DocuSign, again, which is how people are signing a lot of contracts and things like, these are things on the information technology side. When I was talking about Third Rock Ventures, I talked about a couple of things they have invested in on the life sciences side. So the leading medicine right now for sickle cell disease is in our portfolio from the Third Rock Ventures side. They have helped transform, you know, how cancer, you know, is treated today. They are doing things in neurodegenerative disease, you know, things like Alzheimer's that have no treatment. So, I mean, they are taking what's in the lab and they are finding the best professors and sitting down with them and helping them build companies that can generate products and services that literally transform, you know, the world. So this, it's in many ways, you're proud, you know, when you're invested in these kinds of companies and you're not doing it when they're public. You're doing it when it's like a napkin, you know, at a dinner table, sketching out an idea. And so we see a lot of those.
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add to that, Tom, is that when we step back and look at the portfolios that we have built, you know, over time, between kind of 40 to 60% tend to be technology. Another 20% roughly tend to be life sciences, biotech, medtech, devices. And then the rest is a combination of financial services and consumer. But even in that technology group, which is the largest, is incredibly diversified from an underlying industry perspective because we take a vertical approach. So you might have technology that's in an AI space or cybersecurity, but the end markets are very diverse. So you could have AI specifically for a financial services application or AI for healthcare. So there's a significant kind of customer diversity within the underlying portfolio.
No, that's a great answer. Thank you so much. Yeah.
This is Carolyn, and I'd also ask people to identify themselves when they speak, as we're required to do. But would we be doing a direct contract between SURF and Fairview if we do this investment?
So this is Carla. And yes, you would, if you made a commitment, you would get a what's called a limited partners agreement. Your lawyers would, you know, look through it, and then you would enter into a contract with Fairview Private Markets Fund 5, which Fairview is the manager of. And so that's the legal binding contract.
Thank you.
So it looks like we lost Mario, and I don't see Mark. What, Carolyn, what, oh, there's Mark. Hey, Mark. So that's 1, 2, 3. Okay, we have 4 trustees. I thought we lost the quorum. Are there any other questions for Fairview?
I want to thank them for a great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for attending.
Thank you.
Yeah. In this day and age of Zoom meetings, it's not very indicative of this process. So you guys have done well. So thank you for your
appreciate
time.
It. Thank you. All right. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys, you very too. Much. Good have a good rest of your day.
Good thank seeing you. You. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So, hello, do we have everybody here, I believe? So, in summation, you know, Jerry, believe me, I understand where you're coming from. It's a very valid point. You know, the long lockups give everybody, you know, it makes everybody take pause and say, hey, you know, this is a long time, it's a long commitment. The only thing I can say to that is what Cola was mentioning is, and I think it was a response to Tom's question, we're talking about a potentially $5 million commitment because that's what we gave, you know, and ultimately our private equity sleeves are starting to get a little, you know, I want to build out real estate more than private equity at this point. We're almost fully committed to private equity by policy. You know, some of the other funds we have are in a similar structure, maybe not 10 or 12 years. But what Cola was saying is that a lot of this money should start to flow back to the trustees or to the fund, not to the trustees, back to the fund, you know, over time. So if we commit 5 million, hopefully you'll get a million or two back within the first, you know, handful of years. So
Derek, what's their target rate of return?
I believe they said, 1.5 to 2, I think. Dave, do you recollect what they said?
Yeah, it depends on the fund. I mean, he was talking about a 2.5 times multiple, which would be phenomenal. If you looked at the annualized IRR, it was in the probably mid-teens, but multiples easier to think about because you give them, you know, $1 million, they turn it to 2.5. It's 2.5 times. So
it really depends on the fund.
That's the cumulative return over the 12-year period.
Right.
The multiple, the IRR is annualized.
That would mean over 3 years we'd get our investment back, right, Dave?
He was talking about getting, if you do the math, you probably get your investment back. Now, like Derek talked about, the J curve slows that down a little bit, but the real sweet spot in a lot of these funds is about midway because you're getting most of your capital back and you're kind of playing with the house's money at that point in time. Yep. And then the windfall is usually at the tail end of it when you're getting, you know, the substantial return. So you're getting a premium for the illiquidity of the investment, but it is a long period of time. I'm not sure if you guys are going to take a vote, but if you weren't, I got a couple things that I would add to the questioning process.
Derek,
which
I got, Derek, I got to move my car a minute. I'll be right back to vote on it. Right, Derek.
Yeah, I heard you, Derek.
I move my car for a minute. I'll be right back to the table in a moment.
Okay. Dave, you were saying.
Well, I don't want to. If you're going to bring it to a vote, then it's moot. I was just talking about if they're active in the secondaries market, do they have some of their funds that have investors that are looking for liquidity? could we buy a portion of a fund that's a legacy fund, meaning it's already in that stage? I don't think that's the case. But there's other funds out there that do direct investments versus co-investments. And what that means is that they'll cherry pick a few of their individual investments instead of all of them. And usually the time frame on return of capital on those is more in the 6 to 7 to 8 year period. But I didn't know, like I said, I didn't want to impair the process with the question and answer, because that would have taken more time for you guys to come to a vote. So I think you should, if you're going to vote on the merits of what they talked about. If not, we can go back to them with a question or two.
So at the moment, we don't have a quorum, correct? With Jerry in his car. So maybe we just all pause for a moment. It's Carolyn.
I just want to say I followed Fairview for a long time, and they're a reputable firm, and I will support just moving our money from the previous investment to this one.
Kathy, this is Carolyn. Maybe can you just say that when Jerry comes back so that we have it in when there's a quorum?
So there's not a quorum, so we can't discuss about investment part, but what could we talk about in the meantime?
It wasn't a motion, Carolyn. It was just...
No, but I think it's important that Jerry hear that, and I think it's important that it be said again.
Okay. I think we can continue just talking about it.
I think so.
Yeah, until he returns.
I mean, I think as a company, they seem to be very highly qualified and nice people. I don't know.
Yeah. I remember when they started.
Yeah. Oh, do you, Kathy?
Oh, I do, yeah. I remember when they started. They've been very consistent.
Nice to know that they have direct investments with the state of Connecticut, state of New Jersey. So, I mean, they're in the space.
New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah, the resume is definitely not a problem.
I hear Jerry.
I'm back. My car was blocking somebody in the garage.
So my comment is I'm comfortable. I think I asked questions that were of a concern to mine, and I'm comfortable that the lockup, as long as I didn't realize that they would pay the fund, that they would pay the pension back during the course of the 12 years. So with that said, I am very comfortable with the 12-year lockup. I just want to throw that out there. I'm very comfortable of how they invest, because I do have concerns about putting investments into high risk type of, startup companies. And even when Cola mentioned that it's hard to get into some of these funds on the West Coast, it made me feel okay about being in a fund to fund as opposed to them finding direct startup companies themselves. So, I'm comfortable with them, so I'll leave it at that.
And Jerry, what I said when you were moving your car is that I have followed Fairview over the years, and I remember when they started, they've been a very consistent company over the years, and I'm very comfortable with them.
They're a quality firm, Kathy, there's no doubt about it, and I tell you, I like their numbers. It was just the lockup that made me, you had to stop and take pause when you hear that.
Hey, Jerry, one thing, though. I mean, when you have a lockup and you don't get access to any of your money, that's a super problem, and I would have a big problem with it. But because, number one, we could go into a secondary market if we didn't like how the management changed, or also because we'll be getting money filtered back to us, it's really not a 12-year total lockup. It's a sliding lockup. I mean, it's not that we're tying up the money all throughout 12 years.
Right. And they're only drawing it down as they're investing it, correct, Eric?
Yeah, they do. But, one thing that I think you have to be noted of is they do charge their management fee, I think, on commitment.
But that's with any of these types of investments.
Right.
So, trustees, just to remind you, can you just identify yourselves when you speak?
Sorry.
It comes up on Zoom, no, Carol?
You know, You can't. The governor's order says everybody has to say their name when they speak. I'm sorry.
Say your name.
But I didn't say my name when I was
12. Yeah, Carolyn, you didn't say your name.
I really hope this isn't a new normal, because this is tough.
September 6th is supposed to end.
This is Dave. I want to add one more thing. So what's confused a lot of trustees over the years is that you'll make a commitment of $10 million to private equity, and then about 5 years later, there's a new trustee or people just forget. So they'll look at a line item on an investment report and say, well, we gave them five, and there's only $2.5 million left. What happens is with these principal repayments, or there's a term on there that was DIP or DPC or whatever, it's the return of capital. It's very good for these funds because you get cash flow back to the fund. Instead of having to go liquidate a liquid investment, you get cash flow constantly back from these private investments, and it definitely helps with liquidity when it comes to making pension payments. So it'll wean them down. You'll see smaller balances. That's because the return of capital over the years has been put into cash and used to pay pension benefits. So that's one positive out of many with their resume is being great, but that's one positive of the asset class is because you do provide liquidity for other needs.
Jerry, how are you feeling about it? This is Tom Kammer.
How am I feeling about it?
Yeah, about what we just talked about.
Well, I think I have a question for Carolyn. And, you know, the devil's in the detail, and they make it sound easy. Well, if there's a change of management and there's people there that you don't like their style in the future, that you can back out of these arrangements, is it?
We'd have to look at the contract. Probably unlikely, you know, that you can back out if there's a change in management. You're making the contract with the entity, not with the people.
So you'd have to determine that once you get the contract document.
Right. Right. But maybe this is Carolyn. Maybe Derek and Dave also could address this. That, I mean, the contract is with the entity. So if the management of the entity changes, the contract is still binding with the entity.
Right. So I think what we need to remember with all private investments, and this has nothing to do with Fairview, it has nothing to do with any of the things. So there are a lot of different styles of private investments, co-investments, fund of funds. One of the positives of a fund of funds is that let's say that we all love Cola. He's a great guy. He decides to move on and take a position somewhere else, or he sells his position to the firm, and the trustees say, hey, we're not so sure about Fairview. 80% of the fund is invested in underlying other funds. So what they're talking about, that secondary market, when you go to a secondary market maker to break these funds up, those are all well-known names that are big, they're large, they're desirable. So getting out of, you might not necessarily get out of the contract, but what you can do is sell your limited partnership in that fund. So yes, it might be at a discount, but who knows, you know, because over time you would have gotten money back. And, you know, again, nobody knows with any investment you make what the future holds. So I'm not, to address Carolyn's point, yes, this is a contract directly with Fairview Capital, regardless of who's employed there. So that would be true. But again, if something draconian happened at Fairview where your trustees no longer were comfortable with Fairview, you would go to the secondary markets.
Carolyn. This is Carolyn, Derek. So do some of these contracts say that you can't sell your limited partnership interests?
This is Derek. I'm not qualified to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to look at the contract and see.
That's my point. I'm supportive of an investment like this, pending. You know what we go through. In principle, the trustees approve an investment. Then the contract document comes in. It goes to legal counsel. And then there's issues that arise in the contract. The devil's in the detail. I'm supportive of this investment with the proviso that it comes back with a very favorable review by our legal counsel.
Okay, so that's like any investment we make. Yeah. So I think what I'm hearing is all the trustees are saying they like the investment, they like the returns, they like the team. So with that said, I think, you know, we could say, hey, you know, as a financial consultants, we endorse it as well. So we could say, hey, you guys want to make an investment in this fund pending legal review of the contract.
Right? The name of the fund right. that they're proposing?
It's Fairview.
What is it, Kathy?
Fund 5. I know it's Fund 5. I just don't remember the name.
Carolyn. Carolyn, yes. Jerry, yes. The situation that they were talking about a moment ago where if there was a problem and SURF wanted to sell its assets in that investment, is that similar to what we require is going through a capital point?
Yeah.
No, I don't think we could sell. We had to actually fire the general partnership partner.
Jerry, this is Kathy. Jerry, I think you have to let go of what happened on Police and Fire. It was an unusual circumstance. This is a reputable firm. They've done well. I think we all agree that we're comfortable with their investing. And whenever we invest in any firm, it's pending the review of legal counsel.
Kathy, I do have a question. So this review by legal counsel, is what Jerry's saying that if indeed I look at the contract and you cannot sell your limited partnership interest on the secondary market, then I should come back to you? Because usually that is not an item that, you know, we look at when, I mean, I will look at that issue, but I need to have that direction.
Let me finish. Go ahead, Kathy.
I would say upon review of the contract, if it's aligned with the other types of investments that we have, that we move forward.
Right. I have no problem with that.
Okay. So without looking at any of the particulars, it is aligned with the other investments that we have.
All right. This is Tom Kim. Dave or Derek, can you once again go through the secondary market? Because I don't want a contract to get tied up on semantics of what the secondary market is. I'm okay with it. I just thought when they described secondary market was if we didn't like the way that they were investing because a new regime came into management, that it would just go to a secondary type of fund. So it would stay invested as it is with a different management company? What does that mean?
It's Dave Moran. I can answer that because it's a little history with Police and Fire. We had two investments, Capital Point and then the Larry Gray investment, both of which we had issues with liquidity, both of which were very unique and not of anywhere of the size of what we're talking about. I think Eric made a good point with the fact that these are large, reputable private equity firms that they're investing in. So the liquidity issue would be dramatically better. We did engage, Carolyn, with Semaphore, who was actively trying to access the secondary market on Capital Point. However, Capital Point was a minute private equity firm with significant impairments when it came to reputation and everything else that they owned. So the secondary market, Tom, to answer your question, is a market where you had, let's say you had Orange County back in the day that was going bankrupt, and they said they need money, they need liquidity. So these firms go out there, and they take that investment and market it out to other institutions, endowments, whatever you have, and they'll go in there and offer you a price on that. Sometimes, obviously, a discount to what the value is, but you can get out mid-investment at a discount. And that, like he said, Cola said, is that that marketplace has really evolved over the years because of the significant growth in private equity over the last decade or so. So I would look at the contract, maybe something you could ask them if that's in there or not, but there is an active market for it. And I don't think that with the clientele that they have between the state of Connecticut and everyone else, that that is going to be an issue, in my opinion, if you want my opinion.
Good. This is Tom again, just to come back. I'm when I make my vote, I don't want the motion to be on trying to negotiate a secondary market. If it's a secondary market, as they explained, that is standard, then I don't want to waste a lot of time with legal review. I just want to get this thing invested if it's a boilerplate type investment. That's my point.
This is Kathy. I agree.
Well, Tom, I agree with you and Kathy, but by the same token, I think on a 12, you can't deny the fact that this is a 12-year tie-up of money. And I think that, you know, we're paying our attorneys to look at these contracts. And
it's Jerry.
Administratively, I deal with this in a lot more detail in my capacity in the pension administration than the other trustees do. And I'm telling you that the attorneys do find some very important issues that have to be addressed in the contract review.
Tom, understood. Jerry, it's not a tie-up of our money. It's a tie-up of a contract. The money starts flowing back at a certain point. So halfway through the contract, if the rate of return is achieved, we'll have our money back. That's
Tommy, I'm talking about review of a contract before anybody gets money.
Of course. I'm not saying just half-heartedly go without a contract review. Of course.
Well, what I'm saying is the contract is important to me as a trustee.
Of course it is.
And if it takes time, when our attorney comes back and tells us what they found in the contract review, that's an important thing we have to consider.
I agree.
This is Kathy.
If she comes back and says, this thing is fine, I have no problem with it.
Okay. This is Kathy. I move that we invest with Fairview Capital in their Fund 5 pending review of the contract.
All right, a motion has been made by Trustee Graves. Is there a second to the motion?
Tom Kim, a second.
Is there discussion on the motion?
I have a discussion. Just wanted to note, did you mention it? We're looking at a $5 million commitment, just to clarify that.
All right. The amendment is annotated to that effect. Is there any further discussion on the motion? In the absence of a motion properly made in state, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye. Abstain.
I think we should do a roll call because we lost a few people.
There's only four of us left.
Trustee Graves, what is your vote?
Yes.
Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Kama?
Yes.
Trustee Sagnoli, yes.
Motion carries.
Motion carries. Very good.
So that's all I have. That's all we have for you folks.
Mr. Chair, I move for the termination of the meeting, the end of the meeting.
I'll second it.
Second. Discussion. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstain. Okay.
Keep I miss everybody. Please. Hope to see you soon.
Bye, everyone.
Jerry, stay on the phone, Jerry.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye, everybody. Thank you so much.
Bye. Hey, Dave, you want to stay on, Dave?
Thank you, guys. Yeah.
Sure.
Dave. We're going to talk about what's going on with BNY.
Okay.
We have sent an email around. Jerry, did you get the email from Leanna about Leslie?
Yeah, I looked at it. What's he talking about?
Yeah, so Morgan Stanley, it's an interesting situation over there. So when we moved the assets for Police and Fire and Surf, the BNY to Mainstream, all the record keeping and administration.